And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged. This is the podcast committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds. And this is going to be no exception. I think this might well be one of the most important Hank Unplugged podcasts ever. And that's quite a statement, because we have had some of the most extraordinary people on the planet on this podcast. But today, I'm going to host Richard Legutko. And he has written a most significant book. The title says it all. The Demon in Democracy. The subtitle explains further about totalitarian temptations in free societies. The person who wrote this book is a prominent European statesman. He's a distinguished philosopher. He has served as a Polish Minister of Education, a Secretary of State, Deputy Speaker of the Senate, and is currently a member of the European Parliament as well as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee. The book is available to all of you who listen to Hank Unplugged. You can get your copy for your support of our organization by simply writing me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You can also order your copy, again, for your support of our organization on the web at equip.org. I am absolutely delighted, Richard Legutko, to have you on Hank Unplugged.
Thank you. Thank you, Hank. I mean, it's my pleasure being here on your show, and I really appreciate it. And I'm kind of embarrassed by this most flattering introduction. But yeah, it's great to be here and to talk about a problem which I think is the most important political problem in our times. That is, we are living in societies which we were persuaded to call liberal or free, whereas they are less and less so. And this diagnosis is not really clear to everyone. So, yes, I believe that we are living at the time where a new type of despotism is looming large.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. When did you first start seeing a connection between communism and liberal democracy?
Well, that was some time ago, but you must be aware that the first time the thought occurred to me, I didn't want to believe it. I mean, for many years, I had been living under the communist system, and the Western societies were a kind of paradise to us. I mean, we believe that the United States, the United Kingdom, France, all these West European countries, Australia, and so on, they have everything we don't have. And particularly, they have freedom, which we lacked. So when this thought came to me, I said, no, well, that can't be true. I mean, there must be something wrong with my thinking. It can't be true. But the very first thing was when the communist regimes were falling in Eastern Europe, I could see that the former communists were considered to be good guys for the liberal democrats, mostly from Europe, from Western Europe. They were good people. Perhaps they had been misguided in the past. They had committed some sins, probably. But generally, they were not bad. Whereas the really bad guys were people like myself, that is, conservatives, people who were Christians, people who were patriotic, people who believed in the value of classical education. We were kind of, some of us were very, very bad guys, but most of us were people who shouldn't be trusted. Whereas the former communists were good guys because they were progressive, right? They could easily join the current, the wave of progress. They could be made to build a better and more progressive world. Whereas persons like myself were considered to be obstacles. And I said, wait, wait, I mean, that can't be true. And the more I thought about it, the more I discovered that a lot of ideas which I knew in the communist doctrine were also very much present in today's ideology. For instance, the class struggle, that the Western societies, the capitalist society, are divided by two antagonistic classes. Perhaps nowadays people were talking less about social economic classes, but they had other categories such as race, right, or gender, which I consider to be a ridiculous notion. But again, the idea was very close to what I remember from my young years under the communist regime, that the Western society is essentially unjust, unfair, full of discrimination, and there has to be some kind of revolution or profound restructuring of the society to make it better, more equal. It has to be kind of revolutionized. And I didn't want any restructuring. I didn't want any revolution. I knew what the revolution was leading to. And that was very visible at the universities. That is, the universities were the outposts of progress, right? The strongholds of the revolution. And that was, I mean, European universities and also American universities. And I had enough of it. I mean, the Polish educational system had been emancipating itself from this revolutionary thinking. And once the communist system fell, I saw it coming not from Moscow, but from Berkeley, Sorbonne, Heidelberg. So that was the first experience that led me to thinking about it and articulating my argument.
Someone that might be just tuning in and hearing your words immediately starts to think, how in the world can Richard Legutko compare two systems, one which is criminal communism, with another system that we usually associate as a good system, liberal democracy, a system that gives its adherents freedoms and institutional protections? How in the world can you compare those two systems and then say there are commonalities?
I never said, and I could never say they're identical. I'm very aware of the differences, and thank God there are differences. But what's shocking is there are also similarities, and I'm very much concerned by these similarities. Of course, the old regime was brutal and cruel. This one is less brutal. The world in general has become less brutal. But that doesn't make me serene. Just one of the, I think, basic commonalities, basic similarities between the communist system and the liberal democracy. That is, everything in both systems, everything tends to be political. I mean, the society, both the communist society and the liberal society, tends to be politicized. And when I remember my years under the communist regime, we were trying to find some refuge from this politicization, and to have a place where you don't hear this deafening Marxist rhetoric when you don't have to conform to these communist rituals. And there were such places of refuge, such as family or the church, the Catholic Church in Poland. When you went to church, you entered a different world and you felt you are free because spiritually, intellectually, you are in contact with something which you don't have when you leave the church. So there were few areas when you can find a sense of security. Not always, because the church was attacked and the families was attacked. But the society as such was to be communist through and through. I mean, everything was to be communist, or socialist, as we call it. There was no society, but a socialist society, not morality, but a socialist morality, not art, but socialist art. Everything was socialist. If you look at the liberal democratic society, you could see that it's politicized through and through. Everything has to be liberal democratic. There are no institutions, no communities. Or it's extremely difficult to find a place that hasn't been politicized, hasn't been made liberal democratic. Even the family has been more politicized nowadays in America and in Europe than it was in the communist Poland, at least in the final years of its existence. Or religion, right? Or relations between a man and a woman, the parents and the children. Even the toilets, that's the American contribution. The toilets have been politicized, right? This is something really grotesque. But it is grotesque, it's ridiculous, but it's extremely dangerous because there are fewer and fewer places where you can be free from this political and ideological pressure. The language has been changed. We had communist newspeak then back in Poland, and now there is another newspeak here, which is mandatory for many people. I mean, in public space, you are obliged to use this gobbledygook, right? Politically correct in the academia. I mean, this is really frightening. And the things are not getting better, they are getting worse. At least that's my experience. I see this pressure is increasing.
And I think, as you point out in the book, Richard, when you look at liberal democracy and communism, you see in both of them modernization projects. Both want to distance themselves from the past. If an idea is not modern, then it ought to be modernized. And so this is a move, a liberation from old bonds, and even a politically imposed amnesia where memory has to go. You can't think about what happened in the past because everything is about the myth of progress. Everything is utopian.
Yes, I think that's true. I think it goes back to the Enlightenment, which is a very important period in Western culture, exerting strong influence both in the States and here in Europe. And one of the ideas of the Enlightenment was that the society is like a machine. Well, the word machine was extremely popular at that time. Even the human being was interpreted as a machine. And if you look at the human life from that point of view, machine can be made better. You have to modernize a machine, right? Old cars are not as good as new cars. Right? Old TV sets are inferior to modern TV sets. So if you start from this assumption, you want to modernize the society. You want to make the society improved, modernize. You want to have a new modern fancy TV set. So you want also to have a new society. And that means restructuring, right? Changing it entirely and rejecting and eliminating everything that is old because it's not necessary. You don't need old TV sets unless you are a collector, right? That's your eccentric hobby to collect old TV sets. But it's a rather exceptional attitude. So if you want to modernize a society, you reject all the old things because they are not necessary. In fact, they are obstacles to progress. If you remember reading one of the most perceptive anti-utopias, that is Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, and one of the characters asked the leader of the utopian world, why don't they read Shakespeare anymore? And he said, because it's old. You don't need it. I mean, it's in the way of progress. You have all sorts of crazy ideas that make progress more difficult. So you have to reject all these things. And I think the real revolution, this is not a very original view, but I think it's true, that the real revolution, it all started in our times, was 1968. And that was especially in the Western world, in Western Europe, probably in the United States too, because it was the time where the whole system of education, and both in primary schools and high schools, right, the university level, it was changed to make education relevant, right? You have to be educated in such a way that you need to know only things which are necessary for you to find your place in the world and to change this world. From that point of view, Shakespeare or philosophy or theology are not needed, right? They are not necessary. They are in the way of progress. But that changes your mind. It simplifies your mind. It makes it less and less open to ideas. So it closes your mind. And the closed mind of a liberal democrat is as depressing as the closed mind of the former communist.
I think it's probably important to point out that communism made a lot of promises, a lot of utopian promises. And some of those promises were that people could work for less hours, civilization would be more productive, people would have more leisure time, and they could spend that leisure time on licentious pleasures. How did communism promise something that it failed to deliver, and why today do liberal democracies think that they're going to deliver in a utopian style what the communists were not able to deliver?
Well, the communists believe, if you go back to Marx, Marx believed that once you change the economic system, a lot of wealth will be taken away from the rich people and redistributed. Everybody will get richer and people will have their primary and secondary needs satisfied. And then they could devote their free time to intellectual and artistic development. There is a well-known passage in one of Marx's works when he says that in the future, society, a human being will be literary critic in the morning, an engineer at noon, and he will go fishing in the evening or something like this. I mean, you can do anything, you can be everybody because your economic needs will be satisfied. Now, the promise of liberal democracy is a bit different, I think, because first of all, liberal democratic societies are wealthy societies. They are the richest societies in the history of mankind. So that's something that people should be proud of. I mean, there is no poverty, or if there is, it's the margin of modern societies. But I think the problem that modern societies nowadays have are two. The first of all is what to do with this wealth and with this free time that we have. And the answer is entertainment, right? Having fun. This is something that really characterizes the modern world. Never, ever in the history of mankind there have been society which devoted so much resources and time and energy to enjoy themselves. And this also changes our character and ways of thinking. So that's this problem. And the second problem that the modern Western society has is that the society hates itself. Despite all the good things it has produced, the society hates itself. It considers itself to be unjust, unfair, full of discrimination, racism, and very many bad things that has to be eliminated. So on the one hand, when you look at the modern society, on the one hand, you can see people spending millions of hours in the internet, playing games, you know, enjoying themselves. And on the other hand, you have people politically mobilized who want people who are permeated by the woke ideology, who are tracking down racism in the United States because they say that this is the most racist society in the world and a war has to be waged to fight racism. Everything has to be changed in this society because it's been contaminated by racism. And we have similar things in Europe, perhaps not racism, but xenophobia, right, or sexism. This society is so full of sins that you have to create a powerful bureaucracy to fight those things, to fight those sins. So if you combine these two things together, you can see that the modern person is kind of childish, infantile, having his mind changed by being exposed to video games and all these, you know, fun things. And on the other hand, he's constrained, sometimes even enslaved by the huge political and ideological bureaucracy, which controls his thinking, controls his language, and even his games, which are also politically correct. You just cannot enjoy yourself. You have to enjoy yourself in a politically correct way.
In the United States of America, we have an organization called Black Lives Matter, and you mentioned racism. Black Lives Matter is an organization that overtly is calling for the disruption of the nuclear family. So in America, we have major forces that are denying the legitimacy of traditional family. We have the democratization of the family, where young girls can have abortions without parental consent, where, as you alluded to earlier in the conversation, there's a decoupling between sex and gender. Parents are being stripped of their rights, and those rights are now being given to government agencies. So the rights have gone from parents to children or from parents to governmental agencies. Talk a bit, Richard, about how significant the devolution of the American family is, or the family and liberal democracies in general is. This seems to be one of the macro issues that we're facing, because we have herds of people now saying that the nuclear family has to be disrupted. That's one of the first things that has to go in the modernization project.
Well, yes, you're right. I mean, family is the enemy. And family has been the enemy from the very beginning of modern revolutionary ideology, since early modernity, probably. Every attempt to make a thorough reform of the society, to build a new system from scratch, right? To build a brave new world, if I may use this phrase again, had to start with the destruction of family. Family was the major obstacle. If you have the family, you cannot go very far with your revolution and with your restructuring of the society. People will not accept your ideological message because people have been formed within the family by the parents, the grandparents, and there is this cultural transmission through the family. So family is the first thing to go. And that was what the French Revolution did in France at the end of the 18th century. That was what the Bolsheviks did. That was what the German National Socialists were doing. That's what the communists were doing. And that is what the Liberal Democrats have been doing now. Of course, they are using the different means. But family is the enemy. And they have found some ingenious, I would say, methods to disrupt family. This gender nonsense, right, is one. Gender was, still is, right, a notion, a concept from grammar. It's a grammatical concept. They are in our languages, there are three genders. There's masculine and feminine, and there is neuter, right? We all have been taught about it at some time at school. But we have two sexes, male and female. And this gender nonsense became popular first, I think, in the literature departments, where scholars, a professor, were discussing works of literature, and they saw that men and women are playing various roles, and they called it genders. But these were men and women who were playing these roles. They were not genders, they were men and women. But now if you came up with this idea that they are not just men and women, but they are, I don't know, 40 or 50 genders, not only does it destroy the family, because the family is based on two sexes, not on genders, but also you destroy the entire cultural tradition. The entire cultural tradition from the very beginning was based on men and women, right, of two sexes. So in order for your revolution to succeed, you have to reject or reformulate or falsify, if you will, the whole educational system. And so you cannot leave young people, you cannot leave children at home. They have to be taken from home, and they, from the very early days, they have to be indoctrinated. They have to be told that they are, I don't know, 40 genders, right, or 50. That's a massive assault on the human nature. I mean, it's a rape of human nature. It's not some innocent, ingenious experiment. It's an assault of human nature, and you can see the results.
We're talking to Richard Legutko. He is a prominent European statesman. He is a distinguished philosopher. As I mentioned at the outset of the podcast today, he served as a Polish Minister of Education, Secretary of State, Deputy Speaker of the Senate, and he is currently a member of the European Parliament, as well as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee. His book, The Demon in Democracy, available to those who support the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. You can get your copy for your support on the web at equip.org. We're talking about some of the most significant issues that could be discussed, period, in liberal democracies. And I think I want to go back to something, Professor Legutko, and that is the word crisis that threatens to undo Western civilization if it hasn't already been undone. And that is liberal democracy in itself, because when many people think of liberal democracy, they don't think about it in the sense that you're communicating what liberal democracy has become. They're thinking about it in an older sense, maybe during the Reagan Revolution or times back when we thought of liberal as connoting liberties or democracy, meaning that we have an opportunity to elect people through free voting, through legitimate elections, and so forth. You're not talking about that when you're talking about liberal democracy. You're talking about something else. You're talking about this myth of progress, this utopianism, this new meaning that has been poured into the phrase liberal democracy.
Yes, of course, you're right. But let me say that the changes in human nature, the changes in the way people think and speak as a result of this pressure influences also the political structure and the political mechanisms. Normally, we were thinking of democracy as a system where the government is elected through popular votes, right? That is periodic election, right? And that's the view of democracy, right? Who gets the majority then rules for a couple of years and there are new elections and so on and so on. And this seems to be very simple and common sense. But mind you, this is beginning to change too, because there are groups and there are political parties which are believed not eligible to govern because they are politically incorrect and they are disqualified. So even if they win the elections, they are not considered to be legitimate. And you can do anything you want to prevent them from governing. I can see it in Poland. I can see it in Europe. I do not want to talk about the United States, but I think in the United States, there is something like that too, that for 4 years, you had the president who was elected according to the rules that hold in the United States. And yet this president, by very many people, was not considered to be the president from the political party, which I do not like. But he was considered to be the president that shouldn't be the president, that's not worthy to be the president. And I say, we have the same in Europe too. That's what in my book I call mainstream politics. Liberal democracy nowadays is more and more mainstream politics. If you are a part of the mainstream, you are a legitimate political actor. And you are not a part of the mainstream, that it's legitimate to disqualify you, to prevent you from ruling using any means that are available. And if you are not a part of the mainstream, you are considered to be either a fascist or an idiot, a fool, or an insane person. The additional problem to it is that the mainstream is more and more homogeneous. That is, the mainstream is not divided as it used to be. The political spectrum used to be divided between the political left and the political right. Now, as a result, I think, of the 1968 revolution, the political life in the Western world has shifted tremendously to the left, and the right has been cut off. So you can see that everybody who represents the conservative side is excluded from the mainstream. It's immediately you are considered to be a fascist, a Hitlerite, or an idiot, right, or an insane person. So the political system has changed yes, we have the elections, but the elections and the institutions that exist serve a different purpose. They serve to perpetuate the rule of the mainstream and to delegitimize all dissenters. And that's not something what initially democracy was about.
I want to go back to what I was talking about a little earlier when I mentioned the word crisis that threatens to undo Western civilization, where you have words, but there are new meanings that are being smuggled into those words. You mentioned a number of them in your book, dignity. We just talked about marriage, abortion. So let's take those three, for example. Dignity, no longer about moral merit, but about claims and entitlements, or marriage, no longer defined in terms of permanence, gender complementarity, procreation, and the like, but in terms of same-sex marriage. And people will say that same-sex marriage means freedom. And if you don't believe that, you're a fool, you're a hater, and you should be excluded from the conversation. Abortion. Abortion today means freedom. And therefore, doctors are being forced to support this freedom. And priests and pastors who do not support this alleged freedom are silenced. So we have this word crisis. Words are used that seem honorable, dignity, marriage, abortion, but new meanings poured into those words. And I think that's one of the things that threatens to undo Western civilization, the word crisis itself.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. I mean, what is language for? And language is for communication. You use language to describe to the world, to reveal the truth about the world, and not to mystify, not to conceal the world. And nowadays, the language is more and more used to that purpose. And again, let me say, these operations on the language, the manipulation of the language, has always been practiced in the dictatorial and totalitarian regimes. I can give you the example from ancient history, but also the French Revolution. They changed the language. So the first thing they did, apart from an attack on family, an attack on the church, on religion, and on the language, and Bolsheviks, and of course, German National Socialism. And now we have a similar operation. If you read George Orwell's 1984, or also Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, or all these anti-utopias or dystopias, you could see that the very shrewd writers, they were very aware of it, that if you want to change people's natures, their behavior, you have to change the language they use. Dignity. Dignity was a word, is an old word, going back to Roman times. And it was the concept that made you reach for worthy goals. I mean, it's, as you said yourself, dignity is about merit. And nowadays, dignity is not about merit. You have dignity by the mere fact that you were born, and whatever you do, even if you do most undignified things, you do not use your dignity, right? You may be a pornographer and you still have your dignity. So this word doesn't really serve the purpose. I mean, it's used in a completely different set of norms. And there are all sorts of words that have changed the meaning, especially the academics have done their work in this respect. And I don't know what's in the academic world. I've been in the academia for several decades, and I still didn't figure out what's so in the academic mind that it invites regulations and invites despotism. I mean, nowadays they made their life miserable because you have to be very cautious with the word that you use. If you do not conform to a politically correct style, you will not have your article published. And you will not have your article published in the prestigious magazines. And and you may be severely criticized. You may even lose your job if you do not use the correct word. So, yes, the language has been contaminated, unfortunately.
It certainly has. And you're talking about leaders. And one of the problems with leaders, both in government and in corporations, leaders in academia, they're not selected necessarily according to their competence anymore. It seems to me that they're now selected according to their identities. So identity politics has played a real role in dumbing down the leadership of major institutions throughout Western civilizations.
Yeah, again, this is a repetition or kind of a new version, another version of what we had in the communist times here in this part of the world where I come from. Namely, you have there was a quota system, and if your parents were peasants, you had more points and you had a better chance to get to a university or get a job when you came from intelligentsia. So the concept is not new, except that nowadays this identity thing is also rather suspect, because it's not really about identity. I mean, it's about politics, because it's not about women and men and whites and blacks. You may be a woman biologically, but politically you may be a wrong kind of woman. And then if you are a wrong kind of woman, you are as bad as if you are a wrong kind of man. And the feminists will hate you and will consider you a traitor to the feminist cause. So you are not in a better situation after all. So it's a kind of political, ideological selections. You want to have more people whose minds are working correctly, right? Politically correctly. And there is so much time and effort invested into reprogramming of people's minds that young people do not have time to learn at school, to study what they used to study, what they should study, things like disciplines like mathematics or history or literature or biology, because more and more of this nonsense is being pumped into curricula. And all this in order to reprogram their minds. On the one hand, you have this dumbing down phenomenon. It's all over the world, at least in the Western world, in Europe, in Australia, in Canada, in the United States, in Poland. And on the other hand, it's this indoctrination that you do not know mathematics, but you know the stuff about gender and about same-sex marriage and how racist your country is and how it hates homosexuals.
I want you to address the issue of multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is mandating one set of cultural values and saying that those cultural values must not be deemed inferior to another set of cultural values. So you have this multiculturalism encouraging identity politics, the politicalization, which is designed to change the very fabric of our society. So multiculturalism is actually, as you talk about in your book, a hoax that is created under the guise of liberal democracy. So multiculturalism, again, when we hear that word, it sounds positive, but it has a very damaging effect on civilization in terms of how it's actually being posited.
Yes, exactly, because it's not about the multi, it's not about many, it's about equality. It's, again, one of those revolutionary strategies to change and to restructure the society. Cultures, by definition, are not egalitarian. They are not equal. They are hierarchy. Every culture is based on a hierarchy. And usually there is some kind of spontaneous process of achieving some kind of a modus vivendi, a cooperation between communities who come from different traditions, it cannot be prescribed. It's very much spontaneous and depends on a lot of contingencies. There are societies such as an American society, which was predominantly European as far as the origin of the immigrants was. And there are countries like mine, which is more homogeneous, but in the past it wasn't homogeneous. But the groups managed to establish a kind of modus vivendi, and it worked quite well for a couple of centuries. I think in the United States, too, it worked quite well for some time. And multiculturalism is an ideology, egalitarian ideology. So you have these multicultural politicians coming and say, no, we have to start from scratch, we have to rebuild it, everybody is equal, and to make everybody equal, to make every identity equal, you have to perform a very drastic social engineering. If you say that all religions are equal, if you say it in a country which is predominantly Christian or Catholic, saying that all religions are equal and this equality has to be represented politically, then the first thing you do is you discriminate against the Christians because there are too many of them and they are too powerful. So you take all the things that they have, right? You fight against them, right? You attack them. You deprive them of the privileges and the rights they have in order to have equality. That creates, of course, a lot of conflict. It antagonizes the society. So as I said, I think the American society, of course, the American society had its own problems. There was the Civil War and all that, and the states were different with different traditions, different ethnic groups. But somehow, my impression was, also based on the knowledge that I have from books, that it was kind of working more or less, and things were getting better and better. And nowadays, you have this multicultural project, and they say that American society is a disaster, and there has to be a huge bureaucratic apparatus that will set things right. And hence indoctrination, hence ideology, political pressure, and, well, you know about it better than I do.
Well, you know, one thing you know about better than I do is what happened in Hungary. This is a great example of political pressure because here in Hungary, as you write about in the book, you have a country that's condemned by the world at large, and that with rage and hatred for suggesting, simply suggesting, that marriage ought to be between one man and one woman. It's stunning when you think about that. Here you have a country, an entire country, condemned by liberal democracies around the world for saying that marriage is between one man and one woman. We had this same thing in America, by the way, Richard. In America, we had a Supreme Court justice who said that anyone who denies marriage on a whole vast scale of possibilities and suggests that marriage ought to be only between a man and a woman does so out of hate and animus. So we have a condemnation against those who would go back to one of the most basic aspects of civilization in general, not just Western civilization, but civilization in general.
Yeah, it's Hungary, it's Poland too. In Hungary, the problem was that they had the new constitution, and the constitution states that marriage is a union of one man and one woman. And yes, they were attacked viciously. Also in Europe, in the European Union, the deputies, the institution were going berserk. And my country too is one of the villains. We also have the protection of marriage as a union of a man and a woman in the constitution. So that shows a lot of things. First, I think it proves my point about the mainstream. The mainstream is more and more homogeneous. Otherwise, the conservative parties in Western Europe should have protested. And they didn't protest. In fact, same-sex marriage was introduced in Britain. It was introduced by the Conservative Party, in France by the Socialists, and in Germany by Christian Democrats. So you can see the differences between the left and the right is fictitious nowadays. It's no longer there. So yes, it proves this. It also proves another thing, that the liberalism and pluralism is a sham now, because it's you are a pluralist if you do exactly what we tell you to do. If you do something else, you will be condemned. Well, if that is pluralism, I will have none of it. It's like a well-known advertisement of Model T, right? Ford, you can buy any color you want, provided it's black. So yes, that's what we have here in Europe.
I was going to talk about this ideological engine of communism being class struggle, because you sort of awakened my mind to what you've written in your book. So you have this ideological engine of communism, class struggle. And in a liberal democracy, the ideological leverage has been expanded to include some of the other things you were talking about a few moments ago, race and gender. In fact, you call it an ideological triad, class, race, and gender. And they've made this ideology the essence of their religion if you are a media pundit today. I mean, that's the essence of your religion.
Yeah, that is exactly the case. This triad occupies the entire mind. I mean, everything that the modern liberal democrat has intellectually at his disposal to interpret the world are those three concepts. And anything that happens, whether it's literature or society or art or business or politics, is being reduced to this. And this, of course, reminds me of the communist system, where also everything was reduced to this class struggle between the capitalists and the proletariat, from art to politics and economy. So it shows how impoverished the mind is and how helpless this mind is in the modern world, unable to describe what is going on, and even unable to understand the arguments that are being articulated to him. He rejects them because he doesn't understand them. What he understands is only race, class, race, and gender. That's all he knows. The sacred words describing both the bad side, the devilish, the infernal side of modern society, and this paradise that is about to emerge once we do our revolution and achieve our end. So it is both, as I said, the diabolic and the angelic, right? The sacred and the profane. You pray to genders and race, but also condemn people who have it all wrong about race and gender. So it's a rather, I would say, deplorable spectacle. It makes me very, really sad when I watch the public space today in Europe, how impoverished the language and the mental space, and how small the mental space is, that you cannot really conduct a dialogue. You cannot exchange arguments, because these arguments are not understood. They are rejected right at the outset without having them analyzed.
I want you to explain something that's very, very important. You talk about it in the book, that one of the highest values in the ideology of liberal democracy is equality. And you talk about the paradox there. Unravel that. What is the paradox of equality?
Well, the paradox of equality is that in order to have more equality, you have to use more power to secure this equality. People generally are unequal. That is, they may be equal before the law, they may be equal in some metaphysical sense, they may be equal before God, right? But in social life, they are not equal. I mean, they are those who rule, they are those who are being ruled, they are those who are intelligent, those who are not intelligent or less intelligent. They are great artists, they are mediocre artists. They are hardworking people, they are lazy people. I mean, there are all sorts of differences. And that, of course, makes human society interesting to observe how these differences, these inequalities interact. In some aspects, you may be inferior to somebody else. In other aspects, you may be superior, right? You are not a good writer, but you are a good carpenter, or things like that. I mean, this is just a trivial point, but I want to make it clear. Now, if you want to have equality, you have to use coercion. You have to use coercive measures to equalize people. There are institutions which are inherently asymmetric, like schools, right? Or education generally is asymmetric. What you have been observing in the States and what I've been observing here in Europe is that the government has been trying to equalize education. Now, the result is what we mentioned a while ago, is this dumbing down. So being obsessed with equality leads to the strengthening of bureaucracy and bureaucratic system, which wants to see to it that we are equal, although we are not, coercion. But also equality is dangerous in the sense that it disrupts communities. Most of the communities are not based on equality, but inequality. If you make the church or a church too egalitarian, if you make the Catholic Church egalitarian, then you destroy the Catholic Church because it's not egalitarian as far as doctrine is concerned, structure, everything. Or family. Family is not egalitarian institution. They are those who rule and they are those who are ruled. That's not always father, sometimes it's mother, sometimes it's grandmother. I mean, that's the variety of human experience. Families may be different in the power structure, if you will, another horrible expression, but the hierarchy, perhaps I'll use the word hierarchy, but it's a hierarchic institution, it's not an equal institution. So it's egalitarianism as a consistent program, strategy to equalize everything is extremely dangerous. I think it was Alexis de Tocqueville, right, when he visited the United States in early 1830s, and he was very much impressed by the new democratic society. But at the end of the book, he raised some doubts, and he was wondering whether that might not lead this obsession with equality, whether it might not lead sometime in the future to a new form of despotism, precisely because of the destruction of communities and of the necessity to build a huge bureaucratic structure to have equality in place, but also because it changes people's minds. If you do not have respect for something that is superior to you intellectually, spiritually, you will not go far in the process of education or process of improvement of your mind and your sensibility.
Those are fighting words to a lot of people. You mentioned the church, you've mentioned religion, you've mentioned moral conservatism, you've mentioned the family. Is it fair to say that all of those, the church, religion, moral conservatism, the family, are common enemies of both communism or socialism and liberal democracy?
Yes, I would say so. Conservatism, family, religion, from the very beginning was the enemy of communism. With liberalism, it's slightly different. But if you read Thomas Hobbes or John Locke, the founding fathers of of liberalism, you do not see much respect for family. They do not attach an important role to family in the process of the building of a good society, of a well-ordered society. Also religion. Religion for liberals, they treated religion with suspicion. They were not anti-religion, but they wanted religion to be diluted, sort of lukewarm. And they were afraid of what they called religious zeal, right? They were afraid of religious zeal. So they thought that religion should be controlled by the state. That's the argument in John Locke, that yes, there is religious toleration, but the government should supervise whether in worship or in doctrine, in theology, this religious group or that religious group is not subverting the political order. And if it is subverting the political order, it should be somehow eliminated or silenced or whatever. So this was theory. In practice, of course, it was different. There is no reason why the thriving families should not exist in a democratic society, provided that democracy does not become another religion that replaces the real religion. And we are not obsessed with, or we do not fall prey to democratic zeal, and we want to democratize everything. What I said in my book, and is a concept that goes back to antiquity, that the best political system is a mixed system, that is, or as they call it, mixed regime, that is a system which combines democracy, aristocracy and monarchy. And the interesting point is, of course, that the American state or the American political system was construed in the writings of the founding fathers as a mixed regime rather than as a democracy. It was conceived or constructed as a republic, which had a lot to do with the mixed regime, but later on it changed and the American society was becoming more and more democratic. And the president of the United States was endowed with such a tremendous power precisely because it was to be an equivalent of the European monarchs. And this is something that most people have long forgotten and do not talk about, but it's true. The American system came into being as a mixed system, not as a pure democracy.
I want you to talk a little bit about Chapter 5 in your book. I found that a fascinating chapter. I read it over and over again. You talk about the common thread between communism and liberal democracy being the worship of man, the worship of man replacing the worship of God, man becoming the object of worship. And once that happens, liberal democracy then becomes your new religion. And that perhaps is, as you point out, why socialists and communists have always hated religion and longed for socialism to fulfill human needs, to fulfill human dreams, to fulfill the inner desire of humanity the way that religion should and does.
Yes, there was this worship of man, right? God is dethroned, abolished, or killed, as Friedrich Nietzsche said, right? And we have the worship of man. Except that, it sounds tempting for some, except that the man that was being worshipped was the abstract man, whereas the real people were treated very badly. And the socialists, and I also think that the liberals, they love man, although the liberal Democrats nowadays do not use this word, right, man, but they hate people, real people, because the real people are different from this abstract man, and they have all these weaknesses and inclinations which the socialists and liberal Democrats want to get rid of, using coercive measures and politics and indoctrination. So the paradox is that all those men-loving ideologies in practice were extremely brutal and anti-human. Well, you may say that liberal democracy is not as brutal, or is not brutal at all, which of course might be true, but there is some kind of cruelty, I think, in liberal democracy, which may be an equivalent of this brutality, right? Abortion is one of the examples. And not only abortion, but the prohibition of talking about it and raising doubts about it. You are not allowed to do it anymore in various countries. Abortion is more and more accessible, but you are not allowed to call a spade a spade. You are not allowed to call it killing babies, because you will go to prison. You will lose your job. In France, there is a law. You can go to prison up to 2 years and pay 30,000 euros for doing this. So there are all sorts of brutal things going on in Western societies. Most of them are somehow pushed back, and people do not talk about it because that interferes with this rosy picture of deeply humane society full of freedom.
And it's interesting that Christians are falling for this prevalent dichotomy between an inner religion and an outer religion. So what the Christians are doing oftentimes is they're falling for this false dichotomy, making spirituality the servant of politics as a result of that. They're saying, well, we'll practice our inner religion. We won't say anything about abortion. We won't get into those kinds of things. And hopefully the liberal Democrats, the socialists will leave us alone. That seems to me to be a tragic error.
It is a tragic error. And I can see these things happening even within the Catholic Church, which is essentially more conservative than many Protestant churches. But I can see it among the groups that they call themselves open Catholics. And they will accept everything from the liberal, democratic orthodoxy. I mean, everything. They don't defend, they do not criticize, they do not condemn. They go with the current and never object, never criticize. They criticize the conservative clergy, they criticize the church, they criticize more conservative colleagues or friends, right, or groups, but they do not criticize liberal Democrats and the progressives. And it is long ago that I stopped understanding them. I do not know what goes in their minds. I don't believe that their priority is the teaching of the religion. I think the priority is to be a good liberal Democrat. And their religion is subordinated to this liberal democratic creed. And this inner man, outer man, inner religion, outer religion is just a stratagem for them. They're not doing it in earnest. It's a kind of game that they play with themselves and with other people.
And there's another turn of phrase that you use in the book, that of conciliatory Christians and capitulatory Christians. So you have the conciliatory Christians, if I'm characterizing this correctly, who try to adapt Christianity to liberal democracy paradigms. You have the capitulatory Christians who are willing to submit to anything that the liberal democratic members want, and they do that in order to have a quasi-seat at the table. And they're forced to accept humiliating subordination to those things that they actually think are immoral because they want to have a place at the table. And it drives me crazy, quite frankly, because it seems to me that neither one of these ideas is a very good idea, because it is Christianity that is to be the leavening force in a culture that transforms culture.
Yeah, the only Christianity that transforms culture is a full-fledged Christianity. It's not diluted and it's not capitulatory. There's a self-delusion to say that we will, when we get a place at table, we will influence them who are not Christians. They will not influence them because those Christians are no longer in a position to influence anybody. Those who capitulated, if you capitulate, you have very little at your disposal to influence those you capitulated to. And with the conciliatory Christians still have this hope that they can do it, there's this trend in the Catholic Church. You can see it in German episcopate. German Catholics are very much conciliatory, and they believe that they can retain the power, but at the same time, they will not oppose the changes that have been underway in the Western civilization. Well, I don't think they are right, and I'm very much concerned about the Catholic Church nowadays, because I can see that these conciliatory Christians seem to be more and more influential. And, I fear the worst.
There's actually a statement in your book. I just turned to it. It's page 167. And this is one of the most stunning statements in the entire book, from my perspective. You say, if the old communists lived long enough to see the world of today, they would be devastated by the contrast between how little they themselves had managed to achieve in their anti-religious war and how successful the liberal Democrats have been. That is a stunning statement. I mean, you're someone who lived under communism, and yet you're saying the old communists, if they were looking at the world today, they would be devastated by the contrast between how little they managed to achieve in their anti-religious war and how successful the liberal Democrats have been. Expand on that.
Well, I'm, of course, talking mostly from the Polish perspective, and my country has been Catholic since the beginning of Christianity in that part of Europe. We had some Protestant communities, but Catholicism was very strong. And Roman Catholicism was a major force under the communist regime. Of course, the Catholics were treated very brutally. The priests were killed. They were sentenced to long term. And many really bad things were happening. But somehow we survived as a Christian community. And Christianity managed to save the soul of the nation. That is, when the communist system was falling, almost everybody knew that it was the church primarily that helped us to save our soul, that our soul was not remodeled, you know, recycled and changed into something else, thanks to the Pope, John Paul II, among other. But we have many great priests who did this fantastic job. So that's my view, right? That was this very aggressive attack on the church, and we survived as a nation having this identity. And when I see now, not in my country yet, mind you, I use this word yet, but I see the churches in Europe empty or dilapidated or turned into, I don't know, restaurants or discotheques. And I see the spontaneous acts of blasphemy, you know, insulting sacred symbols of the Christian religious. So I could not but arrive at this conclusion. There was not terror used in Western societies, at least not to the extent it was used in the Soviet system. But the results are something that would make the communism envious. The churches in former communist countries are full. The churches in the countries that have never been communist are empty.
Hmm. Wow. You say that we have to recognize that Christianity is the last great force that offers a viable alternative to the tediousness of liberal democratic anthropology. What does resistance look like today?
Well, I said that it's the last great force because we've been separated from the past heritage in education, in public space. We are no longer shaped in a very limited degree, are shaped by the past heritage or classical culture, which for centuries was something that kept us together as members of the Western culture. So Christianity is the only thing left now. And, well, I don't know what the final outcome be. There is no final outcome in history, probably, so we never know. But I think there is some resistance to it. And I can see that the conservative forces are becoming slightly stronger. And this traditional Catholicism also has become more attractive also to young people, because young people, those who are really searching for some meaningful message and a meaningful interpretation of their existence, they want this full-fledged message, not this diluted message that often comes from the popular religion. So I see some signs of optimism, but the enemy is formidable. I mean, it's a powerful machine. It's mass culture, it's corporations, it's politics. So the enemy is powerful. But, well, if we believe that there is such a thing as human nature, and human nature needs some strong message and looks for ultimate meanings and looks for the absolute and for kind of thick metaphysics, then probably there is a chance that this resistance will grow. I hope it will.
You have a new book coming out. It's titled The Cunning of Freedom, Saving the Self in an Age of False Idols. What's that book about?
Well, it's about freedom, as the title says. It's perhaps more philosophical than the previous one, but I'm trying to defend what I said just a while ago. I'm trying to defend a view that there is more to human nature and to human existence that the liberals and the socialists want to allow. And once we are aware of it, maybe we will not be so docile and we will resist this enormous pressure. So freedom is something complex and something that is more about obligation than rights. It's more about spirituality than about anything goes approach.
I wonder what it's like for you, given your political persuasions, to be a member of the European Parliament?
Oh, well, it's on the one hand, it's an interesting experience because you can see you can see modern democracy at work. And I have the first-hand information about the emergence and the growth of new despotism. I can see it right before me. So it's a good place of observation. And on the other hand, it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating because you see that somehow the Europeans didn't draw the conclusions from our history. Perhaps this is the weakness of the human race, that we do not learn by mistakes. We should learn by mistakes, but we don't learn by mistakes. Few of us do. So this is a sad spectacle to see how the old mistakes are being repeated, and you see the emergence of a new despotic system. But, you know, this is a philosopher. A politician cannot abandon his calling, and he must do something. Observing is not enough. So we are giving them a hard time. And, well, we haven't capitulated, far from it, when we have no intention of capitulating.
Well, I've watched you in European Parliament, and you're outspoken, and you're eloquent, and you're brave. And I very, very much appreciate your book, The Demon in Democracy. It's a book that I will be promoting as far and wide as I'm able to, because I think it's not only worth reading once or twice, but at least three times. It's insightful. It causes you to think and ponder the things that we really ought to be thinking about. And as Christians, it makes us recognize that our task is a great one. It's a noble one. It's one that we have been commissioned to by Jesus Christ himself. We are to be the salt of the earth, and if the salt loses its saltiness, it's good for nothing except to be thrown out and trampled by men. The Demon in Democracy, Totalitarian Temptations in Free Societies by my guest, Richard Legutko, is available for all of you who stand shoulder to shoulder with me in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy for your support on the web at equip.org or when you write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Richard, thank you so much for your time. It has been inspiring, insightful, and very, very informative. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I really feel privileged to be able to be on your show. Thank you very much.
And bless you. Again, we're talking to Professor Richard Legutko. He is a European statesman. He's a distinguished philosopher. He's an educator. He's served as Polish Minister of Education, Secretary of State, Deputy Speaker of the Senate. He's currently a member of the European Parliament and a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee. The book, The Demon in Democracy, I can't say enough about this book. It's a book that I have read several times very, very carefully, and a book that will be transformative for you if you ponder its profundity. And it is a profound book. Again, available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. Check it out on the web at equip.org or when you write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. As we close this podcast, I want to remind you of something that I have reminded you of many times, and that is the warning of Jacob Neusner, who said that civilization hangs suspended from generation to generation by the gossamer strand of memory. If only one cohort of mothers and fathers fails to convey to its children what it has learned from its parents, then the great chain of learning and wisdom snaps. If the guardians of knowledge stumble only one time in their fall, collapses the whole edifice of knowledge and understanding. So again, this is a very important podcast in that you have an educator, a politician, a prominent philosopher who is pointing out to us just how quickly we can lose our freedoms if we are not vigilant. And he has pointed out the demon in democracy, and one of the foremost demons in democracy is the word crisis that threatens to undo Western civilization. All kinds of language is being used, but the meanings poured into that language, those words, are the cause of the demise of a civilization that has been the greatest mission-sending force in the history of humanity. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with more.